This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for that introduction, and thanks for making that link to Palm Island from the last talk, as I'm not sure there's going to be that much else that this talk has in common with some of the previous ones, but I think... As Andrew mentioned, there's been a really impressive diversity of talks in this conference, and I thank the organizers for that. I'll get started. This is a collaborative presentation, a collaborative work, and in fact, we have six authors. I originally didn't put the sixth on. She's a member of the Palm Island community, as I wasn't sure she was... going to participate, but she has agreed. And I'd also note that this is a work in progress, and it's evolving. So these are just some ideas that we've had and are going to be developing further. Okay, so I'm going to talk a little bit about resilience. I'm sure everyone's familiar with this term for different reasons, perhaps. It's become something of a buzzword along the lines of sustainability, and I think it's interesting to see how it's currently being discussed in different forms of public discourse, and particularly in relation to Indigenous society in Australia. So I've just pulled up a couple of recent media articles where resilience has made an appearance to look at what is being said and how it's being used. In one, and I won't read it all for you, I'll let you do that, but I'll just note here that this is discussing resilience of traditional Aboriginal beliefs and customs, very much about maintaining cultural identity, keeping cultural identity intact, and even thriving in the face of detrimental government intervention. And here it's about the resilience of Indigenous people and culture. In this one, the author's discussing resilience in relation to children and health. And it's very much about persevering despite suffering at the individual level. Here, this is from the Week in Australia, a week or two ago, and this was about the Northern Territory. This was about the idea that resilience is about autonomy and control, and the ability to actually create and perpetuate the conditions that confer resilience and at a community level. So there's a bit of diversity in how it's being used, but I think they all kind of say similar things. Now, I'm going to jump a bit to talk about this body of scientific theory called resilience theory. And there's this actually has sought to go beyond the sort of metaphor and actually look at resilience as a measurable property of systems, and look at questions such as what makes a system resilient, and how will we actually know if a system is resilient or not? When does it lose resilience? How are we going to identify those changes? Resilience theory seeks to understand the source and role of change, particularly the kind of change that is transforming in adaptive systems. And this comes from the work of ecologists back in the late 90s and early 2000s, but it's more recently been applied to social systems and in a range of different types of systems and in different disciplines, including anthropology and archaeology. Now, the centerpiece of resilience theory is this adaptive cycle that looks like a figure of eight. Now, I won't go into all the details of this, but essentially we can just think about a cycle that systems go through. It's a cyclical change that has different phases. Systems tend to become increasingly complex and rigid as they go through this cycle, and it's not necessarily repetitive. It's possible to exit that cycle and actually transform into something new. Now, again, this was originally devised for ecosystems, but we can think about how this might work for social systems as well. And it has had particular appeal in anthropology, especially in long-term studies of prehistoric societies that have actually completed a whole cycle or more, whereas in a lot of modern societies, they actually haven't gone through those phases yet, and perhaps they never will. There are four key features of resilience theory. One is that change is neither continuous and gradual, and it's not consistently chaotic. It's episodic. It happens unexpectedly at different rates at different times. And if we think about spatial scale, patterns and processes are patchy and discontinuous at all scales. Ecosystems do not have a single equilibrium, but multiple equilibria that define functionally different states. There are destabilizing forces. These can be important for maintaining diversity, flexibility, and opportunity. And stabilizing forces are important in maintaining productivity, fixed capital, and social memory. So again, we can think of social systems as well. Policies and management that apply fixed rules for achieving constant yields or very specific goals that don't pay attention to scale or changing context, and I would also add culture, may lead to systems that increasingly lose resilience. Okay, bringing this to Indigenous communities, resilience theory over the past five, or actually probably more like a decade, has been applied to the study of Indigenous communities for a couple of reasons. One is to better understand these communities from a systems perspective in light of some of the major changes that they are undergoing, and to identify possible solutions to deal with these changes. A lot of the work has come out of Canada. But to also better understand how relevant resilience theory is as an extension of an ecological theory to Indigenous communities. As I mentioned, there's some evidence from long-term studies of societies, particularly anthropology, but less from some contemporary studies of societies. Some of the work that's looked at resilience in Indigenous communities has suggested that local communities with strong connections to place and culturally embedded practices for managing ecosystems, passing knowledge down through generations, can be viewed as coupled social ecological systems. Burks and co-authors have written a lot about the James Bay Cree in Canada and how they've managed through processes of feedback that have allowed them to know when they need to make a change in a management practice. This coupling is a key source of resilience for these communities. It enables adaptation to change and buffering against disturbance. Another idea that I'd like to just talk about for a moment is basins of attraction. So as I mentioned, as one of those key features, systems have multiple configurations, multiple equilibria that we can think of. They can function as basins of attraction. So you might get stuck in one of these basins with strong feedbacks that keep you in that system, in that state. As a system moves from one basin of attraction to another, when a critical threshold is passed, and it can be very difficult to exit that basin that you're in and enter a new one when that happens. So just to give you an illustration, that might look something like this, where what they call on the left-hand side is the ball and cup model, where there's this ball operating or rolling around on the surface and can get stuck in one of these cups where it can't get out again. And we can think about that if we look at the middle picture of the phase space. If you're going on that A trajectory and you get, you know, wound up in that, it's like a spiral. Very hard to get onto the B trajectory once you're there. Okay, if we bring this to a real-world example, we can think of two different states for a lake. And this is an example from Northern Highlands in Wisconsin, where they looked at future scenarios representing these two different alternative basins of attraction. On the one hand, you've got this very pristine ecosystem. You've got your trophic levels, your top predators are intact. There's, low levels of recreation, low levels of human impact. And then on the other hand, you might have a very polluted, very impacted lake. Okay, so that's an example of what those basins of attraction might be. Okay, well, does this resilience metaphor have limits? Well, when we think about these concepts, what about communities that, though they may have once fit those the descriptions of closely connected, connected to place, connected to ecosystems, culturally embedded practices, what if those communities have changed such that those practices and connections are no longer intact? Once they're decoupled from ecosystems, can they be recoupled? And maybe we should ask the question, do they even want to be? Is that an appropriate goal? Many Indigenous communities today can be said to be in maladaptive basins of attraction due in part to changing external circumstances. And these might include political change, policy change, economic change, threats to culture and identity, loss of language and knowledge, environmental change, declines in well-being. And sometimes we talk about poverty traps as an example of that, where it's very difficult to get out of that situation. Okay, jumping now to the research that I'm undertaking now. This is part of a broader program of research that CSIRO is undertaking on Indigenous livelihoods that began in 2008. And our main objective is really to understand what enables or constrains the long-term viability of livelihood options for Indigenous communities based on natural resources. We're looking at 10 or more, I'm not sure the exact number at the moment, case studies of Indigenous natural resource-based enterprises in Australia, and there are a couple in Papua New Guinea as well. This research is not exclusively based or informed by a resilience framework. That's just one of several that are being explored, and that's one that I'm interested in. And my interest in particular in exploring resilience ideas in one of these case studies is to investigate the applicability of resilience as a theoretical framework and a set of tools, given the focus on building scientific research capacity in communities in which we work. So are these actually tools that might be useful to the communities in which we're working? And also to further develop or modify resilience theory so that it can be better used to understand change in an Indigenous community and also recognize that it might have limitations. Okay, Palm Island. As most of you probably know, it's in North Queensland, 65 kilometers northwest of Townsville. The population, I've heard figures from anywhere between 3,000 and 5,000. There is quite a bit of movement on and off the island. There are at least 45 language groups. I've heard higher numbers as well. And there is a traditional owner group, the Mambara, and there is also a group, the Bokomin community, which Barbara Watson, in her PhD thesis in 1993, wrote about this process of becoming Bokomin and developing a new identity for Palm Island for these many different groups. Okay, and the map on the right is just of the recognized cultural heritage body of the Mambara people, and that consists of various different islands, of which the largest is Great Palm, and that's usually what we mean when we say Palm Island. Okay, thinking back to these resilience ideas again, Palm Island is often portrayed as maladaptive. Here's just a recent quote from the Townsville Bulletin, where MP Peter Lindsay said, "The no job, no house policy should be applied to Palm Island. This is a community with no industry, no agriculture, and an unemployment rate of about 90%. It's an economically unsustainable place to live." A resilience perspective would probably do a couple of things, but would seek solutions that can move Palm and other Indigenous communities into more sustainable system configurations. One way to do this is through locally initiated, owned, and managed enterprises. So our research questions were essentially, what are the community's beliefs, attitudes, visions, and aspirations towards future livelihood options? Acknowledging that livelihoods are situated within this bigger systems context that includes ecological, cultural, social, political, and economic dimensions. We're interested in looking at what are the enabling factors and constraints on alternative livelihood enterprises for the community, and ultimately how the learning from this case study might inform a culturally appropriate and environmentally sustainable model of Indigenous enterprise development if such a model is possible. Our methods included a literature review, broad consultation with the community as well as others that had a role in the sponge farm, which I'll talk about in a moment, semi-structured interviews, participatory photographic surveys in which we gave cameras to community members and asked them to capture images of what was important to them about their lives on Palm Island. And what we haven't done yet but will is some scenario envisioning processes to collectively explore future pathways together and some of the implications. The sponge farm aquaculture project was identified by the Australian Institute of Marine Science several years back and local partners as a site for trialing sponge farm operations. It is intended to be a community-owned and operated project by the Coolgardie CDEP, and it involves the growing, harvesting, and marketing of sponges. It's demonstrated to have minimal ecological impact and a recognized market that's been based on feasibility studies and a business model. And in 2005, an indigenous land use agreement was signed, which paved the way for going ahead with this aquaculture project. There are numerous spin-off benefits from this of skills development, connecting community with sea country, developing local knowledge, and raising awareness in the community, as well as cultivating a sense of stewardship and pride in the marine ecosystem, as well as in having a community business. There was a lot of excitement about this sponge farm. This was an article in the Australian Geographic about how they were training the divers, guys that were previously unemployed and were very, very keen about getting in the water and helping to set up the sponge farm. Unfortunately, despite about 10 years in development, the sponge farm has not proceeded beyond its experimental phase and training and faces significant obstacles. The reasons given for this are varied and multifaceted, and I'll go into that a little bit. Some preliminary insights from our research was that there are significant institutional, legislative, and financial constraints. The Palm Island is in the Great Barrier Reef Marine National Park and is subject to a much higher level of legislative requirements than it would have been otherwise. All of this requires more studies and, of course, more financial resources. There are, of course, legacy effects of past policy, and these constrain some of the current actions. It also breeds widespread mistrust, finding that political motivations are constantly questioned of other community members as well as non-Indigenous actors. The economic model of the sponge farm is based on a sort of mainstream economic model and could be inconsistent with some of the culture of non-work on Palm Island, although I think that's possibly questionable. Identity, jealousy, and infighting have also been mentioned a lot. The value of diversity of the many different people in the community ebbs and flows. Sometimes that works to Palm's advantage as a whole, and sometimes it doesn't. It seems that community cohesion, which could possibly be a source of resilience, seems to be latent and activated in times of crisis. People really came together, for example, around the death in custody and the riots that followed in 2005. So just thinking a bit about what this means for Indigenous enterprise, it must be situated within and understood in the broader context of life on Palm. When you start thinking about values, traditions, beliefs, aspirations, as well as the institutional framework and external drivers of change. One limitation of the sponge farm, again, is its basis in externally initiated ideas and a business model that have kind of been passed on, and the need to play by the rules of more powerful federal and state agencies, such as the Marine Park Authority and the Department of Water, Heritage, and the Arts. Even so, it could create options, adaptive capacity, and allow social ecological feedbacks to be built through regular interaction and monitoring of sea country, and instill these values of ownership and pride, as well as raise awareness and education, all of which would contribute to building resilience. So is resilience more than a metaphor? Some concepts of resilience theory seem to apply, such as this episodic change. It's not continuous. It's not smooth. And this concept of a cycle where the effects of the past certainly are constraining some of the current perceptions and options. And what's less clear is that Palm is stuck in a basin of attraction. It seems to be in this reorganizing or growth phase of the adaptive cycle where there's high potential and flexibility for different things to happen, for different trajectories to take hold. So there are some remaining questions that we'd like to explore. Can resilience be built, and resilience that is desirable? It's not always a desirable condition. What do we want from resilience anyway? And, of course, what might Palm Islanders want from it? Should we be asking the resilience of whom for whom? Whose resilience is important? Whose matters? And is it resilience that we're talking about or persistence? That's a question that has been raised by some of the Indigenous community members themselves. How much can a society change and still be considered resilient? So our next steps will be data collection that will continue over the next 6 months or possibly longer through additional interviews, this photo survey, and we also want to collect some historical photos to elicit some perceptions of change since the past. And then we'll do a scenario building and training exercise to identify and explore some alternative pathways for the sponge farm and possibly other future livelihood options and see if these might be consistent with that basin of attraction kind of metaphor. And that's all I have to say. I'd just like to acknowledge the members of the Palm Island community and other individuals who have participated in this research. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Erin. We have time for a question or two. Ian?
Yes, thanks very much, Erin. I see the system model still has some life in it. I didn't really think it did anymore, but that was interesting for a start. But I was wondering, my first thought about your talk about the resilience model was, why are basins of attraction bad? And the answer seems to be because in your model, a system needs to constantly change to constantly changing external circumstances. The coelacanth comes to mind. I mean, the coelacanth has been the same form for many, many millions of years down in the deep oceans, presumably simply because conditions aren't changing very much. So it's perfectly adaptive, but it hasn't changed for, at least not significantly, for many millions of years. So there's a question there. So you're presupposing constantly changing external circumstances, which in turn presupposes a system boundary, of course, which can be problematic. But I wondered what the conditions for something being a system are. I mean, what makes it systematic? Is it the connections need to be sufficient for some kind of continuity, or what? Or is it that what happens in the system conforms to preset goals, which seems to be the case in your case study? That's what defines a system, is the preset goals that somebody gives it. And provided what people do meets the goals, then you've got a system. If they don't, you haven't. You've got some chaos. So those are the kind of thoughts that come to mind about the utility of the model. Yeah.
Shall I respond?
Yes, please.
Yeah, thanks. That excellent feedback. I think that yes, I would, first of all, about the basins of attraction and are they bad? You know, you can have a good, you know, those two pictures I had of the two lakes, you know, we might say, oh, that top upper left one is good, but of course it depends who you are. If you're an industrial polluter, you might prefer the other one. So, you know, it's
that goes to my problems.
Yes, yeah. And I think, I guess that, you know, it is that preserving future options, so preserving sources of novelty and innovation, those are the important things. So, you know, if you're, you know, good, so-called good basin of attraction allows you to do that, then that's fine, you know, so that you can change when change is necessary. What makes something a system? That's a good one. You know, I would say there are, and even within, I'm talking about Palm Island as a system, but I would say there are multiple levels within that. Obviously, there are, you know, subsystems, there are different components, there are different people, different, you know, parts of the community, different groups. So, you know, that's always a question when you're looking at things like that. So, you know, what are your goals and at what scale, if you like, what level? You know, is it for the whole island, for the community, for this group, for this group, for this individual? And I think there are collective goals that the community is striving for. What I'm often hearing is that they have the same goals, but they have differences in how they think they're going to get there, or how they want to get there.
It goes a bit to Diane and Austin Bruce's question about livelihoods, doesn't it? You know, if you have the internal goals which are to an extent met, then in your terms you've got something like a coherent system. If you have it.
Right. And of course those can change, so.
But systems all need agents and feedback loops.
Yeah.
Right. So in your social systemic model, one of the issues that arises immediately is about who are the agents and what kind of feedback are they bringing about. All right? So if you're going to use this systemic model or approach, so within 10 seconds, can you say who are the agents for dynamism within that system?
Mm-hmm.
So you seem to be implying it's the state, essentially, because of the dysfunctionality of the whole community, in a sense, and the incapacity, in a way, for it to have genuine agency, then it's got to be external somehow. So the systemic model starts to break down a bit when you start to say that.
Yeah. I would say it's not just the state. It's not just external. It's the, you know, it's the local council. It's families. I didn't talk about that very much.
Your project's going to identify those kinds of dynamic elements.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right, any other questions before we... Yep.
We actually just started...
Just wait a second. It's absolutely compulsory to be recorded.
Hello? Okay. You actually just started going on to what I was going to ask, and that is how the attitude of Palm Island people go towards what research you've done at the moment. Because Palm Island is one of those Aboriginal communities in Queensland that is constantly being referenced, sourced, analysed by the Queensland government as examples of what Aboriginal communities can and can't and usually can't do. And that attitude constantly feeds back to Palm Island because of the way they're being represented in media and just general policy towards them. How does that attitude then fold through sort of now when we start talking about Indigenous enterprise and autonomy? And I reference particularly the Arts Queensland conference that they had in 2001, 2002, where they talked about Palm Island and the fact that their attitude was was towards industry in a very traditional framework of what work is versus tourism and ecotourism and the Aboriginal experience that the tourists wanted when they came to Australia, and the fact that Palm Island was registered as a place that would not be able to develop that, even though they had the cultural relationships and sort of base cultural information and knowledge that they could have shared and could have developed into that area and sustained themselves as a culture and community that way. But they sort of weren't pushed into that area and basically were sort of told, without being told straight up, that they wouldn't go their way because of their particular community attitude, which was dictated by sort of government policy at that time. How was their attitude now is what I'm asking.
Yeah, okay. So the attitude towards the research, I mean, so when we started engaging with them, it was pretty much through Kugari CDP, who had given a presentation on the sponge farm, which was already happening when we got involved. And so the proposal was to look at some of the questions like, you know, beliefs, attitudes towards it, and understand better what you know, people aspired to. In terms of tourism, I've heard most people seem supportive of some kind of tourism, but very sort of low impact, and again, community owned, if that was what your question was.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.